Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Hello and welcome to Joe's Boys. This is a podcast for little women, little men, and everyone in between. I'm your host, Peyton Thomas. I'm the author of the novel Both Sides Now. I'm also a writer for publications like Vanity Fair and the New York Times. And I'm here today with my extraordinarily special guest, Willa Fitzgerald.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going so well. Willa is an actress who played Meg March in the 2017 BBC miniseries adaptation of Little Women. She currently stars in Reacher on Amazon Prime Video, and she's also starred in MTV's Scream and USA's Dare Me. True heads will also remember her turn as Kitsy Barber in The Goldfinch, which is a special favorite of mine. And in 2012, Willa graduated from Yale, where she studied psychology for 3 years before, luckily for all of us, changing her major to theater studies. Willa, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, I'm so happy to be here, and I cannot wait to talk about this very special Meg chapter.
Yes, we were describing it just now as the most intense sleep training in the history of literature.
Which it really and might maybe be one of the only. Yeah. Narrative-wise sleep training chapters ever written.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about holes in literature and feminist corrections to the canon. Let's get into it.
I know. I can't wait.
I know. This is going to be so much fun. Now, Willa, this might seem obvious. As I mentioned, you have been a little woman, but what is your relationship to Little Women?
I know. I have been a little woman. I definitely read it as a kid. I think I read the abridged first, as I think many people did. And then realized that it was abridged and read the full version, which is a beast, actually.
Yes.
And then I really loved the 90s version with Winona. Yeah, it was kind of my introduction to her as an actor and the beginning of that love affair. And I also just thought that I kind of still think it's one of the most perfect versions of Little Women in a lot of ways, because I think a lot of versions skip over all the play acting stuff, and I feel like that's so special. Yeah. I love those scenes in that version. And then, obviously, I got sent this audition many years ago and absolutely burst into tears when I found out that I had booked it. That's how excited I was.
That's so exciting. And now, we're going to have to get into it now, but which March sister are you? That might be obvious, but... Which one?
It's such a good question, and also one that I think we all have struggles actually answering, because obviously the book makes you want to be a Joe.
Right,
that's
right.
Kind of the function of how the book is written. I think that obviously there's a lot of Meg in me, and I know how much Meg there is in me because I played her. And so it's hard to not identify with her because, I mean, I'm a full homebody. I love taking care of things around my house. And really would choose to be pretty much at home over anywhere else. And I also certainly, though, have a lot of Amy in me. The one character who I don't identify with is Beth, which I think is also not an uncommon sentiment. I think Beth is too good for this world, as I believe maybe Joe says. Some character says that.
She's a cinnamon roll. Too good for this world. Too pure.
I know. I'm not too good for this world.
You're not. I liked you giving us your ranking. All right. So I'm Meg first and then.
Yeah. Aspirationally, so Joe and Amy, but some of the worst parts of Amy, I certainly identify with too.
Got it. So if I can ask, I mean, when that audition came through, did they want you for Meg? Or were you just going out for any little woman?
Yes. No, I did actually go for Meg. And actually, finally, I'm just remembering this now. I think, so Maya Hawke played Jo in our version. And I believe Maya actually might have auditioned for Meg first.
Oh, interesting.
And then auditioned for Jo, or got sent the audition for Meg. And I am so close with Maya still. We are best friends to this day. But... I could never imagine her as anything other than Joe.
Yeah.
But yeah, I auditioned for Meg. I auditioned with the scene where they're in the boat together with John Brooke, I think. And then maybe the scene with Joe's gloves when I'm telling her how she cannot wear those terrible soiled gloves and how she has to wear gloves.
And you know what? You were right. You were right. We should say it.
I mean, for those times, yes, you had to wear gloves.
So with that in mind, Willa, will you recap, please, chapter 38, On the Shelf?
Yes. Yes. I really hope we also talk about the title, On the Shelf, and how that, yep, you know, progresses. But basically, the gist in a quick summary is Meg has the babies, Daisy and Demi. Yes. She is obsessed with the babies, only wants to be caring for the babies. Poor John Brooke feels neglected. So he leaves and goes and hangs out at the neighbor's house. Murray comes over, offers some really good advice about how she needs to stop paying so much attention to the children and stop neglecting her husband, which is, we can't wait to talk about that stuff. Then Meg's like, yes, mother, of course, and decides that she's going to take all of Marmy's advice. And her first attempt to dress up nicely and have a good dinner with John Brooke doesn't go quite according to plan.
No, not quite.
Bad little boy Demi comes marching down the stairs and won't go to bed. And so then Meg is also schooled by John Brooke, who believes that he knows how to parent a child best and basically takes care of sleep training for Meg. And then the chapter ends with them and back into the sort of marital bliss that we assume Meg resides in. But there is, I feel like the chapter at the end kind of redeems itself. I feel like this chapter for me, it goes through a lot of ups and downs with the ways in which it discusses home economics, for lack of a better word, and the divisions of labor. There's times where it feels incredibly anti-feminist and completely undervaluing the work of women. And then it kind of flips at the end in this really interesting way. Where suddenly you're like, oh, wait, interesting. And I think also everyone's, Meg and John's roles get a little bit more genderqueer in the ways in which they're engaging with the home. And so I think that kind of caught me a bit by surprise. I think that there's obviously, for obvious reasons, I don't think any adaptation of Little Women has ever included this chapter.
No, I. It doesn't quite make the cut.
Surprisingly, sleep training does not make the cut for a. Which I think is also an interesting. I think it's interesting to actually think about that when we also think about Meg and why so much of Meg often gets cut out of adaptations of Little Women when they're brought to the screen or the stage, because Meg is leading kind of the least narratively compelling life by especially modern standards, but even I think Alcott standards.
So thank you for that. You have brought up so many fascinating points. I think the first one I just want to touch on is the stuff that gets left out when Meg's story is adapted. This scene didn't make your version.
No.
You did get kind of alone among adaptations. We got Meg's whole birth scene and you got this gorgeous moment with Emily Watson as Marmy.
Yeah.
Where you're like, how am I going to do this? And she's like, I asked my own mother that once, and someday you're going to ask your daughters. And I'm like, it's really moving.
I know. Well, that I think that's because we got that, because the woman who adapted our version is the force behind Call the Midwife.
Oh, fabulous.
Yes. So I think that she has a special interest also in childbirth, and especially period childbirth. But yeah, no, I was really excited that that was in there. And I also think, I don't think it made it in. You've probably watched it more recently than I have. I don't think we had the jelly scene. We shot the jelly scene.
Yeah.
And I think most of it got cut. It was at one point a lot longer. I don't know if it actually was even in the, I can't remember. But yeah, I think that Meg is the version of womanhood and femininity that I think even feminists over time have had the most difficulty kind of squaring up to. And I think especially in reading Little Women as a feminist text or a genderqueer text or any of those things, I think Meg is the most difficult character to kind of deal with.
Yeah.
Because in a lot of ways, she is doing the work that is most quote unquote traditional.
Right.
And I think that it's also, she's also doing the work that I think maybe because of misogyny has been least interesting to viewers and readers. And Alcott writes this whole chapter about sleep training.
I know, it's such a correction to literary history. So why haven't there been any sleep training scenes?
I know.
Didn't that make it into men just aren't thinking about this at all? They're not putting it in their 19th century novels. I think I had the same reaction as you. My reaction reading this chapter, it was like, I don't know if you've ever seen that reaction gif of the guys on the side of a basketball game and they're leaning all the way back, looking really scared. And then they relax and start flapping. And that was completely me. It was like, okay, she turned it around.
Totally.
She brought it back.
Totally.
She starts by saying, whether they like it or not, new brides are virtually put upon the shelf as soon as the wedding excitement is over. And most of them might exclaim, as did a very pretty woman the other day, which is probably Meg, I'm as handsome as ever, but no one takes any notice of me because I'm married. So it's this sidelining of Meg that unfortunately some adaptations just replicate. Once she's married, that's sort of the end of her. When actually, as you were saying, with the jelly scene, with this chapter, we get some really interesting looks at negotiating married life in a way that is respectful of Meg's interests and boundaries and allows John Brooke to take an active part in the childcare, which is a lot more progressive than, well, she's married, she's done, she can get shunted away.
Totally. And I think also, I mean, in this chapter too, the next line is, not being a belle or a fashionable lady, Meg did not experience this affliction until her baby's for a year old.
Right.
And not being a belle or even a fashionable lady. There's actually a lot of the class in this chapter too.
Yes. Oh my God. Yeah.
And social status and economic status. And I think that's also an interesting part of the home life that we get this glimpse of, because there are interesting class dialogues and commentaries in Little Women, which are maybe the less touched upon and adaptations and stuff. But you know, I think that that's an interesting amendment to the On the Shelf as the title.
Yes. Yeah. It's Sally Moffat, for instance. Her experience of married life is very different because she doesn't have kids to look after. She has this many servants to look after the home and make her jelly.
Yeah.
Right?
So, exactly.
I wanted to say, I loved, before we get into anything else, I love the texture of the jelly scene. I was just watching it. You can see the sweat on your brow as you're like, come on. And it comes out just liquidy.
It's such a good chapter. I kind of love that chapter just because, I mean, I've been there. I think one of the ways I relate to Meg the most is perhaps in the ways that her frustration relative to what is actually happening is always not quite calibrated.
Yep.
Her frustration is always exceeds the actual stakes of the situation. And that's something that I really resonate with deeply.
That's where we see that she's Joe's sister. She can take things to 100. But another thing we've been tracking throughout the book and which shows up in this chapter is just Meg as a sexual being, someone with sexual agency. Toward the very end, there's a part where she says, look, I got advice from Marmee about how to kind of work on her marriage. I've been neglecting you. I want it kind of more even balance. You don't object, I hope. And then the answer is, never mind what John said, or what a very narrow escape the little bonnet had from utter ruin. So he flies at her and they start making out, is the implication there.
I literally wrote S-E-X-X-X on my copy of it.
it parallels a moment, I think, in the jelly scene. Well, it's when the whole silk coat debacle happens.
Yes. In the jelly chapter, when she's wearing the coat and shows it to John Brooke, and then you're like, and we don't know what happened, but then she's pregnant.
I know. So these scenes happen. They're very sneaky. You kind of blink and you'll miss them. Well, not you didn't miss them. You had it in the margins. You're like, I know what's going on. We were doing some Victorian flower language decoding around Meg's wedding, and it says that she refuses orange flowers, which we found were symbols of purity. So she's immediately like, listen, I know what I'm doing on my honeymoon.
I know. And it's also interesting too, because you see some of the sexual politics too.
Yes.
When they're like, everyone was better for this division of labor, which is shortly after it implied sex scene.
Yes.
And it's the division of labor within the home is something that then contributes to their positive sex life. Which is something that sex therapists would still tell you today. That's the unspoken domestic struggle between a couple, whether it's a straight or non-straight, queer, whatever couple. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that actually interfere most deeply with sexual connection and marriage. And Alcott's talking about that.
And she never married.
Little Women.
She never married. She's just getting all of this from her older sister, Anna Alcott's experience of marriage. So clearly they were talking about this.
Oh, definitely.
Speaking of sleep training and having a healthy sex life, that's also like major for couples with really young children. I can start actually sleeping at night and doing other activities at night again.
Exactly.
So I think it's important to kind of push back against this notion that Meg's chapters are anti-feminist or not, because we're really getting a sophisticated negotiation of how to be a woman in a straight relationship and how to be a man in a straight relationship and share duties equitably. You mentioned they both become kind of more genderqueer in this chapter. And when the babies are conceived in that jelly chapter, Meg is wearing John's coat. Right here, it says,
yeah,
when John is feed training Demi, he has the patience of a woman, or womanly patience, I think, yeah, is the quote. They're sort of melt their, yeah, the strictures of gender a little bit. And it's very cool to see that.
Totally. And yep, it's also interesting too that Meg didn't expect that of him.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
When she stumbles into the room and sees that,
yeah,
that John is being gentle and soft in this way that she's surprised, mm-hmm, by. She's like, oh.
Yeah. It's just very sweet. I think Marmee comes through. She has really good advice, not just about keeping your husband happy. That's not really the point of her advice. But she says, at one point I highlighted this, was keep cheerful as well as busy, for you are the sunshine maker of the family. And if you get dismal, there is no fair weather, which is a very cutesy way of being like, protect your mental health. Postpartum depression is real.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good way of reading that. I actually underlined that because I was like, emotional labor.
Right.
Because that was, I think Marmee gives good advice and bad advice,
yeah,
in this, in the same breath.
Yeah.
I like that reading of it a lot more than mine, which was very defensive. And I was she's asking,
yeah,
because I think that also Meg's journey throughout the entire book, mm-hmm, from Vanity Fair through the jelly, yeah, through this, is Meg finds herself embarrassed and troubled, whatever, mm-hmm, when she's showing the mechanisms by which femininity / womanhood is created, yeah, whether, yeah, that's getting dressed up and being proud of her being dressed up, or trying to make the jelly and not being, mm-hmm, able to, or not being able to put the babies to bed. That's what her conflict is, essentially hiding,
yeah,
the,
yeah,
layers of labor that go into the construction of a home, the construction of femininity and womanhood.
Yeah.
And I, yeah, think that is essentially kind of dated.
Yeah, no kidding.
Mentally draining,
yeah,
activity.
Yeah. It's like,
and I think that's why Meg, I think, is sometimes challenging to access, mm-hmm, because that is kind of her main character arc, is becoming Marmee. And Marmee's like, I'm angry every day of my life. And yes, I hope that in 40 years, I will be able to not be angry. But right now, yep, all I can do is hide my anger.
Yeah.
And so there's all these subterranean layers,
yes,
of the actual full expression of who these people are as human, being
right,
kind of,
right,
like stifled by the mother or,
oh,
wife,
completely,
or,
yeah,
just woman layer of it.
Yeah, which I think we're seeing here. Even at home with her husband, initially Meg feels a desire to just bury that.
Yeah.
This is going to bring up a question I wanted to ask toward the end, but I might as well say it now. I loved your adaptation. It really kind of took us behind the curtain with Meg, both the birth scene alone. That's not even in the book.
Yeah.
It's suddenly she's pregnant, then the babies are here, and Meg is not even in the room when babies are introduced to Lori, which is very strange.
I know. It's so weird.
We have that whole scene with you. We also, at Vanity Fair, we see afterward your feet hurt and you're kicking out your shoes and shoveling down ice cream that Lori brought you. There's a scene, you're going to the bathroom, yeah, I think, and you have about 5,000 petticoats that you're managing. Is that?
I think, if I'm not misremembering, I think I was the one who was asking you to. And also, when we were shooting Little Women,
yeah,
we were always trying to find places to pee outside, because let me tell you, going into the little porta potties with all of those layers,
oh, no,
of skirts on is so terrible. Yeah. It's impossible. So we were always trying to find a spot in the woods to like go. There's a lot of fun stuff that we learned because we had a woman from Orchard House with us, Jan, yeah, Turquist.
Yeah. Love her.
When we were, yeah, shooting. And she's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And she was telling us about how the girls, and especially Joe, would run,
yep,
miles every, yeah, day in their corsets and their petticoats. And, mm-hmm, and we all grew all of our body hair out because Ness, our director,
yes,
really liked when the close-ups, being able to see leg hair and, mm-hmm, armpit hair. And so we all really went for the grit. We were like, we're going to be living at the same time period.
No, I love that.
But wait. Your question was about the side of Meg that we,
yeah,
don't see, which in the book would also include armpit hair. But yeah, I was really excited when I read all of the scripts and I saw that there were those moments included. And then also when I was kind of thinking about how I wanted to play the scenes that were kind of less Meg-centric, but,
yeah,
still had a lot of Meg in them. And I think that you kind of said it earlier, there is a lot of Joe in Meg. It's just,
yeah,
in a different direction, because also written by the same person.
Yep.
there necessarily is. And it was really important to me as an actor to give Meg the most humanity possible, because I think that a lot of time the versions that you see on screen are kind of, I feel like they are the kindest, most benign version of the character. And I was more interested in, especially in the book, the times that she loses her temper, the ways in which she struggles with the things that she wants, and also not having control over her sisters, and the power dynamics, which I think you actually do get a large peek at in the book that aren't always seen in the adaptations that we have. And so I kind of felt there was a lot of room to play with a side of Meg that we haven't seen on screen before. And that was something I was really excited about.
Yeah, I think, just because yours is a, it's a mini series, right? So it's 3 hours. You have just more breathing room than you would in a regular film adaptation. We get to see more of those private moments. I think it's really special, because I think there's the public facing, very emotional labor side of Meg, and there's when she's alone with her family. I was wondering, we had a listener ask if you did any research on Anna Alcott when you were preparing for your role as Meg.
I did. I think Louisa, I think that she, there's so much writing that she did. There's also a lot of writing that Anna did. And there's, all of those things are still available and accessible. And Jan did a great job of giving us a lot of that material to kind of look through when we were doing our adaptation, which was really fun, especially for a nerdy person like myself. I really enjoyed getting to have access to that primary source material. And it just kind of, because I think Anna was really different than Meg, is the interesting side of that. Anna was much more of an introvert, a lot kind of more serious, studious than Meg is kind of superficially on the page read as. And Meg and Anna and Lou had a really intimate, very connected relationship. And that was also kind of an interesting thing just to kind of have in the back of your head. And that's the beauty of getting to do an adaptation. And the beauty of Little Women, everyone brings all of their own stuff to this book. It's read in so many different ways across the globe. The amount of translation Little Women has is insane. And I think it's because there's so many different ways that you can read all of these characters. And in doing an adaptation, you kind of just get to pick what's most interesting to you and what you kind of are most interested in exploring. And I was really interested in that relationship with Joe, and also kind of really interested in kind of exploring the stuff that's either written in between the sentences or kind of in what we know their life would have been like actually as the Alcotts.
Yeah. I love that you got to see the primary source stuff, because that is so cool. I've been in the archives
myself. It's really cool.
My favorite one, it was a script, I think, that was co-written by Anna and Lou. And Anna's handwriting looks like a computer font. It's pristine. It's perfect. And then Lou comes in and it's chicken scratch. So, but it's the fact that Anna did writing. Anna was very curious about theater and the stage. They were both kind of, Lou and Anna wanted to be actresses. Yeah. So very similar to you, it sounds.
Yeah. It's also interesting, the thing about acting, that that's the background and also part of the big background for Meg, and also much of her just work as a character or as a person in the world was creating this presentation of womanhood.
It's this comfort with putting on femininity and then how that differs in the back. And it's occurring to me, you mentioned Anna and Lou had an extremely close relationship. After Anna's husband died, Lou actually adopted, well, much later, but wrote in a journal saying, I must be a father to these children. So maybe some of the sleep training, house management stuff is from Lou looking after Anna's children.
I love that.
Seeing how that works. I think, I don't know how old the kids were when the husband passed, but I think they were relatively young still. So it's not,
I love that,
speculation. The other thing I wanted to mention, because we were talking a lot about how Meg does get angry, and some of these crowd scenes are really hard for her. My friend Eliana Dobris is an audiologist, and I chatted with her about Meg a while ago just because I was curious. We know that Anna had a hearing impairment. She used what's called an ear trumpet, a preliminary hearing aid. And Eliana brought up that these loud, noisy group settings would have been really hard for her because she would have to work extra hard to hear people and continue to talk to people and stay pleasant. And I think that adds so much extra context to these situations where Meg comes out of a social event. She's been grinning the whole time and she comes out super flustered. She's just, even here with her sensitivity to Demi's cries, it literally is, it's more acute for her. She has to just work harder to hear. And that's kind of in the background of it all.
Totally. I know. I love the, when they're talking about the, what is it they call it? Maternal delinquencies or something like that, I think. Yeah. Is how they refer to Meg not being able to have a firm hand with her children. And it's such a massive just misunderstanding of the fact that, yeah, yes, that's because she's been at home with them nonstop all day. Like, so no shit. She's just trying to do anything to get them to go to bed. So good for you, John Brooke. Glad you're on your maternal side. But also, you be able to have a firm hand is because you've been gone over at the house across the street for 6 months.
I'm just going to go over to my neighbor's house and not hang out with my wife or my kids.
Right? Exactly. Exactly.
It's need crazy. To call John Brooke out. He needs to be brought to the red table.
I know. John Brooke needs, he could have a lot of things called out.
I mean, he rises to the occasion, I think, in the end. But it's interesting that I think Marmee gives good advice. I like what she says here about don't shut yourself up in a bandbox because you're a woman, but understand what is going on. Educate yourself to take your part in the world's work, for it all affects you and yours. I'm like, fuck yeah, go Marmee. But
yeah, totally.
Yeah. And Meg says, I'm afraid he'll think I'm stupid if I ask questions about politics and things. And Marmee's like, I don't believe he would. And truthfully, he doesn't. But
yeah,
it's notable that John Brooke isn't going over to his parents and being like, I'm neglecting my wife. How do I stop doing this? Right?
Totally.
The onus falls on Meg to manage the situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think is something that we see time and time again throughout her entire trajectory, but especially here. And I think that, I love that last line that Marmee has about pay attention to the world around you and the news of the world. And I think that she gets to such a great place, even though Marmee's advice does not start in a great place.
Not quite.
Because she starts by saying, basically, she goes, don't you neglect him? I think the fault is yours, Meg. And it's like, really, Marmee?
Excuse me.
Stolen out that, it's your fault that your husband cheated. It's basically the subtext of that, right? That, if we want to read it a different way, that's blaming the woman for the cheating husband.
The cheating, do you consider going over to the Scott's house and playing chess and listening to the piano cheating? I mean, what does
I think it's emotionally. I think it's emotional infidelity, maybe. Uh-huh. I think for the time period. But then Marmee literally says in that next part, she basically says, you need to pay attention to your husband so he doesn't cheat on you. There's literally a line in which that is the subtext of it.
I wish I could find it
right now, this moment.
Let me look.
I underlined it, I know, because I was like, Oh, okay, yes. Meg, one had better, a very natural and forgivable mistake, Meg, but one had better be remedied before you take to different ways. Our children should draw you nearer than ever, not separate you. And, that wasn't the right line.
Yep.
But there was another line, basically, where she's like, he needs to care about the children so he doesn't cheat on you.
Make it so pleasant he won't want to go away.
That, definitely. Yep. But there's one line that is very much that I was like, I underlined too many things, but I'm realizing. But what's funny about this chapter, too, is half of my underlining is from 2017 or 2016, whenever we were shooting
And
half of it's from a week ago when I was rereading this chapter. So it's very hard to know
what
it's talking about.
If you find it, let me know. But I think that reading is definitely there. I think there's sort of, even just where Marmee loses me and she's like, you have to make yourself look pretty, right? You have to put that blue bow in your hair.
Yes.
And what I like about Marmee's advice, though, what I think we're also seeing is she's essentially saying you have to emphasize to John that he has a place in raising the children as well. You have to bring him into that. It's his domain as well. We know that Bronson Alcott was incredibly involved with the childcare of the girls, right? He, with both Anna and Lou, he had books where he jotted down everything they did. He was like, Anna breathed today. He was very interested in educational techniques, was very active in bringing up the kids, often to the point of not being able to kind of make a living outside the home or hold down a job, which was very unusual for men of that time. So I think some of this is Alcott looking at her own parents' marriage, which was not always happy, but she could certainly vouch for a very present father figure.
Yeah.
Which we're seeing
and
here.
And that also stemmed from kind of his connections to transcendentalism. Yes. All of that was part of the experiments that he was conducting. The oddest children.
Yes. He was like, I'm going to
find it. But I did find it.
Yes. Okay. Tell me.
It says, don't let John be a stranger to the babies, for they will do more to keep him safe and happy in this world of trial and temptation than anything else. And through them, you'll learn to know and love one another as you should. Make him want to be a parent so that he factors that into his desire to be bound to the home.
We don't get a ton of outright discussion of adultery in this book, but obviously it was going on. And obviously, yeah. as you're saying, I think there is, maybe we're getting, if anything, too shallow a picture of Meg as so wrapped up in her baby, she barely even notices John is gone.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter to her at all that he's across the street at the Scots with their chessboard. I think it's, we get to a point where kind of Meg realizes that she's been lonely and isn't sure how she can kind of get that early wedded bliss back. It's sad that she has to be the one to take up the burden of making that happen and that there's no parallel discussion with John going on. We don't get a whole lot about John's family here, do we? What's his situation?
I think that we assume that he doesn't really have any.
Okay.
Because they're never, I don't think that they're ever at the wedding.
Right, right.
He's also, it seems like he's far away from home and would work for the Lawrences.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so too. We don't hear about his parents or the way that he was brought up. He's more entwined with the Lawrences. And I think he's working for Mr. Lawrence at this point as well. And it's just interesting.
I know. I was trying to remember. Yeah. I couldn't remember what he was doing for work.
Business.
Or if they ever talk about it. Just his doctor in business.
He's off doing business. He's off. We don't know what he's doing all day. He's just making spreadsheets.
He doesn't know what Meg's doing all day.
Yeah. And so I like that finally they come together. I like that Marmy suggests that Meg take an interest in his interest. And I actually like that Meg really tries to get into politics and is like, I'm sorry, this is just so boring.
I know. I underlined this one where it says, Meg tried to look deeply interested, to ask intelligent questions and keep her thoughts from wandering from the state of the nation to the state of her bonnet. And you just pictured Carrie Bradshaw being like, I tried to keep my mind on the state of the nation and the state of my bonnet. So good.
Speaking of works heavily influenced by Little Women, Sex and the City, there's four of them. They're completely different.
I guess that's true. Wow. Yeah, like, I hadn't even thought about that. Maybe.
Yeah. I think Meg would be like,
we need to go through and identify who all the people.
So I feel like Meg is the Charlotte of the group. Does that track?
Yes. Okay. Meg, Charlotte. Amy is probably Samantha.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. I guess Beth is Miranda, but also maybe Joe is Miranda.
I think Joe is Well, it sort of falls apart there. So I think we have two Joes and no Beth.
Yeah, I know. That's true. Double Joe. Maybe they're both Joe and Beth.
It's hard to say. No, Beth doesn't.
That's so funny.
The friend group picked up another Joe. And that's, you know what?
Exactly. Happens. Double Joes.
So, my goodness, we've talked a lot about breeding Meg in a feminist way, right? And thinking of these family scenes and child-rearing scenes as not anti-feminist, but feminist, right? And feminism as it relates to the family. I brought it along today. Have you read Beautiful World, Where Are You by Sally Rooney?
Yeah, okay. I have.
So I wanted to bring it today. I don't normally bring outside reading, but this is a passage that I think, I mean, we're both sharing notes on books, but I underlined Meg under this one.
Oh my gosh, I love it. Are you going to read it?
I am going to read it. It's from the last chapter of the book. So one of the characters has just found out that she's pregnant and she's essentially deciding whether or not she's going to have the kid. And she says, she's kind of raising these things of global warming, should people have children? And she says, neither you nor I have any confidence that human civilization as we know it is going to persist beyond our lifetimes. But then again, no matter what I do, hundreds of thousands of babies will be born on the same day as this hypothetical baby of mine. Their futures are surely just as important as the future of my hypothetical baby, who is distinguished only by its relationship to me and also to the man I love. I suppose I mean that children are coming anyway, and in the grand scheme of things, it won't matter much whether any of them are mine or his. We have to try either way to build a world they can live in. And I feel in a strange sense that I want to be on the children's side and on the side of their mothers, to be with them, not just an observer, admiring them from a distance, speculating about their best interests, but one of them. I'm not saying, by the way, that I think that's important for everyone. No matter what we think or fear about the future of civilization, women all over the world will go on having babies, and I belong with them, and any child I might have belongs with their children. It's just
beautiful. I forgot about that. I totally forgot about that passage, but I absolutely love it. And I think also I need to bring in another work of great writing, Rachel Cusk. A Life's Work. My best friend just had a baby who's now 5 months old, and so I've been deep in my baby dump too with her baby.
Yeah.
And she was reading that while she was pregnant. She was like, can you read it with me? Because I want you to be able to talk to you about this kind of stuff. And I mean, talk about an amazing sort of look at motherhood for both its incredible difficulties and triumph through the lens of someone who's had a baby and is going through the journey of understanding what it means to both desperately want to have selfhood outside of that baby and feeling also incredibly guilty for not being with the baby and only wanting to be with the baby.
Right, right.
And it's actually such a great kind of companion piece of modern writing to sort of think about the ways in which Meg obviously wants to be with the babies all the time. Like, also, the babies are only like 6 months old.
They're
or
very little. Well Demi's talking.
For some reason, I don't understand why Demi's talking. That doesn't make sense. Because also, at the beginning of the chapter, she's like 6 months have passed since the birth of the babies. The timeline doesn't line up for a developmental baby dump.
Or Demi is a prodigy. That's also a possibility.
Demi's a prodigy.
Go on.
We also need to talk about how Daisy is called Daisy, and that was Meg's name at Vanity Fair.
It was, yes, because Marguerite is the French form of Margaret, and that also means Daisy in French. So it all...
I know, but don't we feel like she had a really bad time being called Daisy at Vanity Fair? Didn't that seem not a highlight of her life? And now looking back on it, she's like, you know what? I'm going to name my daughter Daisy.
Maybe... In the fullness of time, she's like, you know what? The way everyone treated me around that, when all I wanted to do was have a nice time, was really fucked up. So I'm reclaiming.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I can't say.
I'm reclaiming.
She's reclaiming. But yeah.
I just thought that was so funny.
So yes, Demi is a child prodigy. He's walking and talking at 6 months.
Exactly.
That might be Lou Alcott's unfamiliarity with that period of raising children. But yeah, I think essentially this is... It's not that marrying and having children, of course, that belongs in feminist literature. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And what we see with Meg, I think, if we look at the context of this, when this was written, right, it was, and actually your adaptation does this really well, it was a time when families were separated, mothers' sons were out dying en masse in this unbelievably bloody war. There's a kind of an extended sequence where Meg and John marry, and then he goes off to war, and you're waiting for him to return.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, everything feels apocalyptic in a very immediate sense. Probably people were sitting around having the same discussions about, is it ethical to bring a child into this world or not? Right. At that time.
Yeah.
With things so unstable. And that's to say nothing of knowing how young people die. Right. You have to factor that environment of grief into it. And so in that context, I think we can really celebrate Meg's desire to just be part of the stream of mothers and children, right? It matters.
That's such a great, I'm so glad you thought of that passage from that book, because it is such a perfect companion to kind of thinking about that. And I love how she says, I love what she says about wanting to not be outside of it, but to be inside of it, in the stream. And I think she also even includes whether or not that means have this child, to just be involved in the world of children and the rearing of them, which Joe was and Lou was.
Which Lou very much was. Yeah.
Even that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Joe goes on to create the school for boys.
Yeah.
They all are very much in the stream of children, which is really kind of beautiful.
Isn't it? In fact, there's a letter that I love, which is a very angry letter to the editors from Lou, where she's responding to a charge that she's a suffragist and she has no children. What are we to make of that? Yeah. She's neglecting her duties. And she's like, listen, my entire life has been in the service of children. I've been a governess. I write books for children.
Yeah.
I am a father to my sister's children, right? How dare you? She's really getting into it.
Oh my gosh, totally.
Even though Alcott probably didn't identify as straight, had no desire to get married.
Yeah.
It was important to her to be part of raising children. And when that meant adopting Anna's children, it meant when May's, the real life Amy's, passed away, her newborn daughter came to America and Lou raised her, right? She loved kids. And it was...
I know. Yeah. And it's so, I love, too, the ways in which... I mean, one of the things I really love about Little Women in general is the ways in which gender just don't function in the ways that we would think they would in Little Women. And it's something that is so clear throughout the entire book and has been clear, I think, in subsequent adaptations. I don't... You know, like it's very present in the Winona Ryder version. But there's even a passage in some chapter where Meg is described as being manly. And all of these little women have these moments of this sort of queering of their gender identities and the roles that they're taking on in the world. And when thinking about the ways in which Joe is all of these things to the children in her life that are just genderless. and are more kind of an exploration of the ways in which we serve many different functions as teachers for the children
completely
around us. That's, I think, really cool. And I think it's very present in queer partnerships with their children, obviously, because I think those parents serve a large variety of gendered but gender-free teachings. But I think it's also interesting that we see that in Little Women in a way that, you know, even outside of just Joe, who obviously is the most sort of genderqueer character in this book, even Meg, and I wish I wrote it down. I was looking through my notes from 2016 when we were shooting this, or 2017.
Yeah.
And I found this quote where Meg is described as manly or something. And I'm like, I love this.
It's been known to happen.
Everybody gets to have a go.
Everyone gets to have. I mean, it's so funny when even in Joe's play that she writes, she's like, I'm a girl with three sisters and the play has one female part and we're all their lives.
Yeah.
So everyone kind of gets to play. Not everyone. Joe kind of explicitly expressed a desire to be a man.
Yeah.
And the others may express feelings about the limitations of being a woman, but with them, it's more about egalitarianism and strictly wanting to be a man.
Yeah.
I think we really see that here when it's a lot of Marmee's advice is about invite John into motherhood. See how he likes it. See how he likes getting to fall asleep holding the kids, which is really lovely.
And I know it's about sharing the experience and also allowing the other to critique in the experience of something that was so strictly divided along gender lines at that point in time in particular. But even today.
Even today.
And divisions of household labor and straight couples. I think that's a recurring theme.
I don't know how. I like to think we've come. But that's the thing. Probably you could write a novel in 2023 where someone has twins and the dad goes right back to work, maybe out of economic necessity. And they neglect each other and the mom gets really wrapped up in the kids and they have to have this come to Jesus moment. Like, you're going to take that. This could happen today, right? In a very real sense. You wouldn't have to change
Very much. It totally could.
I think.
And also it's all structural because think about how few places have paternal leave.
Right.
You know, it's all still baked into the literal structure of our economic society.
Oh my God,
social, you know?
Another part of this, which we haven't talked about, is the Marches may not be wealthy, but Marmee can say, we'll send our servant over. Hannah will help you. You can have two servants instead of one, which I think about the economic conditions of being able to employ a servant already, that's not a guarantee for everyone, right?
Yeah.
And then we hear about those servants being Irish and there's another level of class racial stuff under that. which again, you could transport very easily on kind of modern class racial dynamics. It's very interesting. It's very multi-layered. It's very modern. I don't want to keep you here past the hour. So I do want to, Sean, Meg, I want to ask you a couple questions from listeners, if that's okay, about your time as Meg.
Yeah.
So are there any Meg scenes that wound up just not making your script, but you wish you could have done?
There was actually a lot more to the birth scene.
Oh.
Than was actually made the cut into the final. But it was a lot more intense.
Oh, yeah.
I was surprised and a lot longer. And I think that was, I think that you got what you needed, but I think that there's also part of me that's like, I wish that they would have been able to keep a longer cut of that scene because I thought it was a really beautiful scene with Marmee and kind of a real actual picture of what it meant to enter motherhood and kind of a metaphorical portrait of that entry and its difficulties. And I think also, I think that it would have been, I feel like our version on the page too did kind of struggle with how to show Meg's married life past the jelly scene, which I think is a very common struggle with adaptations. And it's a huge book, as we said, it's 400 something pages. So there's a lot to fit in and there's always a lot that doesn't make it, but it often does feel an adaptation. Meg gets married, you might see one little glimpse of what's happening after, and then she's kind of gone, which she's literally put on the shelf, shelved until a later date. And so, and I think that was one thing that even when I was reading the scripts, I remember just kind of wishing that there had been a little bit more of just her with the children or her as a person who came back over to the March house as she was frequently visiting and stuff.
Which she is.
But I think there is often sort of a disappearance that happens. And I think that was something that I felt when I was playing the character that I wish that there had been more of.
I completely agree. Someday we will get the completely Meg-centric version. And it's all about her.
I know, right? As an actor, that's literally what we always want. We're like, my character is both the best and worst part of having a conversation with an actor. We're and like, well.
And I can imagine you're like, obviously, you must have been like busting your ass with like a childbirth act. And hello, that's
you're like, ow, wow.
So was there, with that in mind, was there a really, what was the most special day on set? Not even a scene necessarily, but just
that
one.
That is impossible to say. Okay. Because honestly, I think any, if you talk to any of us in that show,
yeah,
I think we would all say that it was the most special time in our professional lives.
Wow. Okay.
Because we all, like, we shot it in Ireland and all of us, Jonah, Maya, Annas, Catherine, we all just became enmeshed. We literally were all living in this little hotel south of Dublin together for 3 months almost.
Wow. Okay.
We had dinner every night. We had breakfast every morning. Mm-hmm. We were fully, we hung out in each other's rooms whenever we weren't shooting.
Yeah.
We just, and we also were all actors kind of at a critical moment in our careers where I think we all were just starting to get to do what we actually wanted to be doing.
Right, right.
And I think that there was this kind of sense of real possibility and potential.
Oh,
and I think it was just a really special moment for all of us individually. And it made magic when we came together and we all just fell in love.
Yeah.
And so literally every day was incredible.
Okay.
I can there were just so many when we had the snow, because obviously it was not snowing in summer in Ireland. They make it with, I don't even know what it is, but the ground was covered in snow and it looks like real snow. And we were just throwing at each other, we're sweating, everyone's being sunburned. We're like having a snowball fight outside, not even scripted.
Oh.
I really loved all of the scenes at the party at Vanity Fair. Yes. Those were really fun because it was, you know, I think it was, it's also like a, Meg loves being a performer.
Yeah.
And it also this really fun time, especially without having those scenes from the book in the, that is actually, I forgot to say that.
Yeah.
I really wish that we had had. And it also makes Lori look better in that moment that he does in, on the page of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, I loved that because I didn't have a ton of scenes with Jonah.
Yeah.
Gosh, I mean, there's so many good ones. But basically, all of the scenes of us being with all of the sisters were just, we had the freaking time of our lives. And one really, and also Emily Watson, who played Marley, is incredible. And also was really a mother to all of us while shooting, because she's had an absolutely incredible career. And like I said, we were all kind of very much at the beginning of getting to do interesting stuff. And she was so incredible for really just showing us, more than even telling us, what it means to be like an actor on set and what it means to take the space that you need to get ready, what it means to ask for what you need in order to do your job. Yeah. And also Angela Lansbury, too.
I was going to say.
I remember having, I know, I remember having lunches with Angela when she was with us, her work ethic up until the last thing that she did, which I don't know what her last project was before she passed, but her work ethic was just incredible. And she always would talk to us about the ways in which she, as a young person, prioritized what she was doing. And it was just, it was a really special and incredible project to be a part of.
Yeah.
That's amazing people.
I know. And that's so, the Jonah you mentioned, that's Jonah Howard King. He's in the new Little Mermaid, which is very cool.
So excited. Yes. I want to see what it is.
I want to circle back to Angela Lansbury, because I saw your Instagram post that you made when she passed, just saying it was the honor of a lifetime to be able to learn from you. And I thought that was just beautifully poignant. Like, you got to fucking act with her. You had, you preserved the entire argument scene when she comes in and she's like, if you marry this schlug, I won't give you any money. You get to deliver the line. You can leave your money to anyone you like.
I know.
What was that like?
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, she's so generous. She's she was so generous and so kind. And at that point, because she was 91, I think, when we shot that.
Yeah.
So obviously she was not really memorized and she had cue cards. But even reading off cue cards that were variously around my head, she's just incredible. It was still, it was just a testament to the fact that when you know what you're doing and who you are at a scene, it doesn't matter if you're reading or if you're memorized.
How?
And also she would, I mean, what a person to say those lines to.
Yeah. I saw Catherine Newton just commented on your post and was like, we were so lucky. And I feel like it must have been just-
we really were. Cause she took that, she wanted to have lunch with us, you know?
Yeah.
Like, not, you don't always eat lunch with people when you're on sets. Oftentimes you go and eat in your trailer for various reasons. Sometimes you're just tired.
Yep.
But she would always eat with us at lunch, which was just so special.
Wonderful.
She wanted to talk to us about her life, which, you know, and she had so much to share. It was just incredible.
Yeah, it must have just been
that
wonderful.
That kind of generosity is not to be expected.
No, I
and
would
when
imagine.
You encounter it is really so special.
Yeah, I'm so glad that she really made herself accessible to you. Because as you were saying, it was a time when you all started to feel, oh, and now I'm doing what I really want to be doing. and the fact that she was present for that to guide you into the next step. And you and Maya and Jonah, Catherine, we're all seeing you in all these amazing projects now. It sounds like, I don't know, like summer camp or something, but that's it wonderful dynamic.
Was. Yeah. I mean, it was literally summer in Ireland and we were all just gallivanting around and corsets and petticoats. There are just so many videos of us at lunch because we would take off our dresses because we weren't allowed to eat with our dresses on.
Of course, yeah.
In our corsets and our petticoats, dancing. It was wild.
So fun.
We had so much fun.
Okay. So one last question. Sorry, I don't want to keep you here too much longer. What do you think?
It's fine.
This was a listener question. What do you think Meg would be doing in 2023? What would she be up to?
I mean, I think that what's interesting about Meg is I think that what she was doing in the time that she lived was kind of what she wanted to be doing then and what she probably would be doing kind of now. I think that she would be a person who wants to have a very full home life, wants to live near family, wants to raise a family. I wonder if maybe given the fact that now you can also do other things, whether she would have wanted to be an actor at a regional theater or something like that and keep following those hobbies in a more active way into her married life. But I think that what's interesting is we kind of see the historical is also in the present through Meg, where she is a person who wants to be a homemaker, who wants to have a very active family life. And I think that the ways in which she would have done that would be different now, just because I hope that we have moved forward in some ways. But I mean, as we saw in this chapter, there's some stuff that they talk about in this chapter that is very modern. And I think that's kind of what is amazing about her as a character.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think probably very little. I would like to see Meg doing community theater, maybe Meg doing bonnets on Etsy. I don't know. She's very into that bonnet.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah.
I know. And also, like, she would have a great garden.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
She'd be gardening. Like, maybe she'd be part of her horticultural society.
Yes. Conservation. I could see
the gardening club.
Yeah. Very into that.
You know, I think that she would definitely find, I think there would just be more room for hobbies.
Yeah.
Either making those professional or not, but it wouldn't be so much of a choice of can one have a family and be a wife, or can one also do these other things? There'd probably be more room for both.
I like that. I think modern Meg would have more freedom and really still be herself, probably still have arguments about how to sleep train. Some things truly never change.
100%.
Yeah.
I know.
Well, Willa, thank you so much for being here today. I mean, the insight that you've brought to this character, I would love to see more of your notes. If you don't mind sending some pictures our way, that would be very exciting.
Oh, of course.
Where can people find you online? How can they support your work? What projects do you have in the pipeline? What's going on?
I'm really only on Instagram.
Okay.
And on Instagram, it's really only my dog.
Okay.
So sorry, but that's what you're going to get if you follow me on Instagram. And it's just Willa F. Fitz.
Okay.
And upcoming, I actually have a lot of really fun stuff coming up. I have a Mike Flanagan series on Netflix called Follow the House of Usher.
Very cool.
It's also literary. It's inspired by the collected works of Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, that's so
and
cool.
It's really, really well done. It's very exciting, especially if you're a nerd of Poe and his work. You're going to find so many Easter eggs. You're going to lose your mind.
Love it. Love it.
So that's very exciting. I also did another book adaptation, actually, called Desperation Road, which is written by Michael Ferris Smith. And it is about all of these interconnecting stories in the Deep South. And I think people kind of have referred to him as John Grisham of Mississippi.
Love that. And very intrigued, like, immediately.
Yes, I know. It's actually, I have the book over there. I wonder if that actually is the quote.
Okay.
Let me grab my...
No worries.
And then I also... No, I don't know. It doesn't stay on here. And then I also have a movie called Strange Darling, which I did with Miramax, which is not a literary adaptation, but it's kind of a cat and mouse thriller, two-hander wild ride that also should be coming out in the fall. So the fall will be a very busy time, I think, actually. And lots of fun stuff.
Fabulous. I mean, the Fall of the House of Usher is on Netflix, so you can go and watch it right now. Pause and the episode and just go do that. And as always, I'm your host, Peyton Thomas. You can find me online at peytonthomas.ca. You can buy my book, Both Sides Now, wherever you buy books. You can also now find us on Instagram. We are at Joe's Boys Pod. Willa, do you want to take a picture real quick for Instagram?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Let's do it.
We're making sure I'm like framed in my thing.
Okay, yes. You look fabulous. Okay. Amazing. Thank you so much. All right. Thanks for listening. Thank you for being here, Willa. And we will see you next week.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.